So today we are going to discuss your questions. It's open lines. We have already a number of questions. You're welcome to chime in by chatting with us if you're joining us on DimDim, which, by the way, the class that we're in on dimdim.com is kosher. And if you're joining us by via the telephone, which is 218-895-1203, the passcode is 2020 pound, and we'll show you. We'll be able to. If you have a question, we'll tell you how to join in a minute. Zev, the volume is low. We have a comment here on the dim. Can you? Okay, so. So let's, before we get to the questions, let's talk a couple minutes about things going on in current events, Rabbi Rosen. We were talking before the show about what's happening with Turkey and Israel and all of the issues that are coming up with Turkey's creating difficulties for the Israeli government and Israeli people. And how does that affect the hashgachas, the certifications that we give and other agencies give in Turkey? And that's your department here. One of the many things, I shouldn't say the only thing, but among the many hats that you wear is you're in charge of the certifications in Turkey. So how does that, if we can't travel to Turkey or whatever the issues are, you want to address that for a minute?
It's a very good question, and it's really left us, the kashrus agencies, with a great concern. This week we had the Fancy Food Show in the Javits Center in New York, and in Turkish Pavilion, very heavily is certified by Star K certification. At the present, because of the situation, all of the certification agencies have pulled back their supervisors. To our at least comfort zone is that we do not have productions that have to be on an ongoing basis, as some of the certifications in Israel that are being done for their producers. So even though we would have a hiatus, we are there periodically and quite frequently. Right now, we are waiting to see a certain lull in the action. Politically, right now, it does not bode well, and hopefully, the companies are hopeful that the political situation will quiet, because they still are very anxious to get kosher certification and to be able to come and be a player in the U.S. marketplace.
Okay, so basically, if I could just reiterate what you're saying, is that the agencies that certify product there on a constant basis, they may have some difficulty getting in.
Correct.
But the ones that are like us, we're just there from time to time.
Correct.
Okay. So how long can we go without being there?
I guess in our comfort zone, Rabbi David Stein, who is our field representative that comes from Rehovot to Turkey this month, is at least in these couple of weeks his certification route is taking him to Europe, to Italy and Spain. So Turkey was not supposed to be on his agenda until the end of July. So hopefully by then, that July is the time when apricots are in full production in Malatya in eastern Turkey. So we are hopeful that by that time there's going to be a significant change in a relaxation in the travel.
I mean, is that really, does it look like that? I mean, to me it looks like it's going the other way.
The only other fail-safe is that Rabbi Stein is traveling on a U.S. passport, as is other mashkichim that we use even from Israel. It is an Israeli... It is an Israeli problem more than a U.S. problem, and if we have to go ahead and to reorganized by taking a supervisor from the United States, we may have to go that route.
Okay, so you're saying that it's only an issue right now for Israeli citizens, but for an American citizen, they could go without a problem?
Correct.
We would be comfortable sending someone there.
Well, hopefully we'll be comfortable.
Okay. All right. Okay, that's an answer. I mean, that's really brings to fore the concept that we're not there constantly. We're not producing, we're not have a shechita over there, a slaughtering house where we need to be there all day.
Correct.
We're producing things which are relatively simple. We go from time to time. Okay, so let's go to some of the questions first that we got by via email. Okay, I see now that the volume is working better on the dim-dim, so thank you, Zev. One question that we have is grape juice considered wine, and therefore one should not drink it during the 9 days? During the 9 days, meaning after the first of the month of Av until the ninth of Av, which is Tisha B'Av, during those 9 days, we don't drink wine. And the question is grape juice considered wine?
Grape juice is considered wine,
right.
And it is important to note that in Shabbos we do make Kiddush on wine. However, on Havdalah, typically there's been the custom to make Havdalah during the 9 days on beer. So people maybe get an overdose of wine over Shabbos and make it on grape juice. So I think that it's a good time to try Sam Adams Starkey certified beer.
That's a good point. That a lot of people do make Havdalah on Saturday night on beer. I personally do not, so I have two options. One is I go to Rabbi Rosen's house for Shabbos and I have him make Havdalah. The other option is I have one of my children. Usually we try to pick a child about 6 or 7 years old, and they make Havdalah. They don't make Havdalah, they drink the grape juice. Or the Rama says that if a child is not available, then he himself, the adult himself, can drink grape juice. For me, the beer is just not really an option, Rabbi Rosen.
Rabbi Goldberg's too young.
So, okay, so that I believe that answers that question. Another question has to do with the 9 days, with that period of time that's coming up, which is a sad period of time, is a remembrance for the destruction of the temples in Jerusalem. Is someone who completed a Masechta, which is a tractate of Talmud, prior to the 9 days, such as the tractate of Makos, which those who learned Daf Yomi just finished this past week, this a couple days ago, are they allowed to hold off on making the Siyum until the 9 days? So is it usually a party made or small party celebration when one finishes the tractate of Talmud? And the question is one allowed to hold off on that until the 9 days when, and during that celebration, have meat, drink wine, and so on? And
well, typically the halacha states that one shouldn't time it in such a way that it's as a convenience that you would have the Masechta finished earlier, and then you're holding off till the 9 days. I think that in certain cases, although the halacha states we shouldn't go ahead and save it so you can have a nice steak dinner. I know, personally, that some people would make a siyum for a yahrzeit, and is a daf yomi is a studier, so they would probably take that, and that's as they've planned it for their completion, which is right now that they'll do it.
They would hold off, you mean, until it's planned until they finish on the yahrzeit, which would be fine. But again, like Rabbi Rosen is saying, the Mishnah Berurah rules that one should not hold off on finishing a Masechta, and so then we finished Makos this past would be Monday, and so to hold off basically 2 weeks or more, I don't think would be our custom to do that, especially since Makos is a very small Masechta relatively, and you know, there are those that do it, though. There are definitely those that do it, and if one has that custom of that it's okay to hold off, then they should follow that. There are authorities who allow it.
Right. Interesting to note that Rav Ruderman, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of Ner Yisrael, the founding Rosh Yeshiva, in my days when I first came to Baltimore, that it was customary that in restaurants that there would be one person to complete a masechta, so that the participants in that restaurant would be have a fleishig meal. It was Rabbi Ruderman's concern that people, if they did not have a place to go to have a kosher meal, would go elsewhere, and that was a fear. That was in, well, obviously Rabbi Ruderman started the yeshiva in the 1930s. I came here at the beginning of the 90s, and subsequent to that, we no longer do the one masechta completion in restaurants during the 9 days.
What is our policy on that? Don't we have some restriction on the meat restaurants? Is it only for takeout? Am I right? It's not our. We don't take care of it directly, but I think it's only.
But I think what we have in the restaurants that they have 9 day menus that are
right. They would have
able to have fish menus during the 9 days.
Fish
during the nine
right.
days.
Okay.
Fish without worms.
Fish, right?
Without worms. You know, farm raised fish.
Fish or dairy?
Or dairy.
But and if they want people want meat, I think they can take it out.
Correct.
Is that right?
Okay. Because there is no control.
Right.
It could be for Shabbos.
Right. Maybe the person is making a siyum.
That's correct.
Maybe the person is not feeling well and needs the meat and so on. Now, speaking about the fish, we do have a chatted question here, and I encourage everybody to, if you have a question on what we're talking about or anything having to do with kosher, to chime in. Does Rav Belsky Shlita still hold that all kosher fish, even those with anisakis, is kosher without any check-in needed? And the answer is yes. Rebelsky still does hold like that, and the OU's policy follows that, you know, his opinion.
Then, interestingly, as we had the article on the Anisakis in the latest Kashrus Currents, which at the end I concluded that this issue is still in its process of formation. Other notable poskim, I guess redactors of law, have written responsa. Rav Padua in England recently wrote a responsa permitting the fish, as Rav Moshe Vaya, who is renowned in Israel as being the premier bug expert, permits the anisakis in fish, and Rav Falk, who has wrote a response earlier, still holds. So the jury is still out on both sides of the issue.
Our Starkey policy is to follow those gedolim in Israel, in the land of Israel, who are forbidding to eat the anisakis.
Right.
Currently, that's our policy. If anybody wants to see it in writing, you can go to our website, star-k.org, and right there on the front page, you can hit the button that refers to this issue, and it will come up. One significant change that we did have was with salmon, canned salmon.
Correct.
That's wild, which normally would be a problem, but based on various halachic reasons, that it's questionable whether or not they're in the can or you can find them in the can. Rabbi Heinemann is now allowing the canned salmon, obviously with reliable certification, as long as you mash it up like you would normally when you make a salmon salad with mayonnaise or whatever. So that is a significant change. I think that will be well received. Okay, let's go to some other issue here. Speaking about the bugs still, we can't get away from the bugs and the worms, Rabbi Rosen. It seems to be with us. Nori sheets.
This is not bugs and worms. These are crustaceans.
Okay. I stand corrected. Nori sheets, what are the problems with them? Is there an issue of bugs? Do they need to be checked?
The answer is yes. Nori sheets, which are pressed seaweed sheets, very popular in the sushi community, have to be checked to make sure that in its process that small seahorses are not contained therein. Typically, nori sheets would go through an electric eye check to make sure that there's no other foreign matter other than seaweed that's in the sheet. And I think that these electric eyes are sensitive enough to detect if the mass matter it would not match the seaweed, so they would be rejected. So we only certify those sheets that go through such a check.
And then we do check some of them afterwards. We follow up with
a spot check.
Spot checks. So if a person wanted to buy uncertified, an unflavored, because if it was flavored, it would need a certification for the flavoring, just plain old roasted nori sheets, they could if they know how to check it. But it takes some, it does take some
A lot of book training takes expertise.
Right, it does take some training, and we're waiting for Reb Zev Steen to put together a video how to check nori sheets, because we've got the strawberries, we have the flour, we have the, what else do we have? The what?
Lettuce.
The lettuce. So we're waiting for the one on the nori sheets. That is, in a nutshell, that's the nori sheets. We have a question here that's being chatted. There's a GE oven which has two ovens, okay, a bottom and a top. The bottom drawer heats up to 450 degrees. Can one cook milchiks in that bottom drawer oven at the same time that fleishiks is in the upper oven? I think we concluded not at the same time. Is that right?
Well, I think you have to make a determination how the ovens are vented. If the ovens, and that's a very important thing to realize, that an oven vents, either some of the older models will vent in the back of the oven, some ovens are vented in the last, I guess, northwest burner in an electric oven, and a double oven can at times be either vented separately but then coupled together. And if that is the case, that you will have both meat and milk venting at the same time, you may have a bus of a hull of a meat and milk issue in terms of its cooking.
So right. So I believe that we our policy is that if they end up, or they have two vents, two separate vents, but
and
they join at some point, you cannot cook meat and milk at the same time, but separately you could. Unless one oven vents into the other oven. I think we're on alert for that possibility,
yeah,
too.
Right.
The bottom one may vent into the top one and then from there go out. If that's the case, so then
it's really
you couldn't even use it at all for meat, one for meat and one for dairy.
Typically it's really vents from the back, and I think that it's important to go ahead and check with the manufacturer how your GE oven is configured.
We do have, some of them are Starkey certified, and then we should have that information available on our site. I just want to identify us for those joining us late. I'm Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg. This is Rabbi Tzvi Rosen, and we're here in the Starkey offices in Baltimore for our monthly teleconference, which is on the last Wednesday of each month, except for next month when it will be the third Wednesday, which is July 21st. The day after Tisha B'Av at noon. Okay, here's another question, Rabbi Rosen. This gets a little bit sticky.
Go ahead.
Is the agency OU the same regarding reliability in Israel, the same as it is in the U.S., and is there a Starkey as well here in Israel? Okay, this is a question from somebody who's residing in Israel and wants to know about that.
That's a very good question. And you, if you are residing in Israel, as you know, Israeli kashrus is I wouldn't say a political hotbed, but it's a kashrus hotbed, which is far more complex than we have in the United States.
Which I tell people is counterintuitive. Right? People think that in the United States, you know, it may be, there's so many different certifications. I think the last Kashrus magazine listed how many hundreds in the United States, maybe 500 or more. And they think when they go to Israel that, you know, Israel is the land of the Jews and it's easy to find kosher there. But in truth, like you say, it's more complicated.
I'll give you an example where there's a profound difference between the OU U.S. and OU Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, the OU would consider themselves to be what we call a Mahadran Hechsher. Mahadran Hechsher would be the ones which are more scrupulous, because as mandated by Israeli law, everything has to have a certification before it can be sold, and therefore they will rely on baseline certifications to be able to give the highest common distribution of kosher products to the masses. Those who are actually desiring to have a more high-end kashrus, which they call a Mahadran Hechsher, a Mahadran certification, which the OU considers itself in Israel, as well as Star K, that their standards would be even tighter in Israel than you would in the United States. For example, in the United States, you can purchase star-kissed tuna fish with an OU, where the OU will not require full-time supervision on the tuna fish where it's being produced. While in Israel, the star-kissed tuna fish with the OU has full-time certification, full-time supervision on it, and they will not sell the regular star-kissed in Israel because it would not be considered to be of a Mahadran level.
Okay, as far as probably what he's asking is also including the restaurants and so on that the OU is certifying there, and I don't think we would want to comment necessarily. We don't have direct knowledge, or we didn't review the restaurants and
right.
so on. But we did have experience with some of our certifications there a number of years ago. We did have a Star K Israel program where we started the procedures of giving certifications to some restaurants, and we found it very difficult, a very difficult environment to keep to the standard that we would require over here
right.
in a restaurant situation.
It's important to note that in Israel, where you will have certification being given by an agency in both a restaurant and in a hotel, hotels typically may have a more strict setup because each hotel has its own particular Rav HaMachshir, rabbi who's a resident rabbi who is responsible for the hotel. In a restaurant, it's not as tight, and therefore you would have to really have to check each particular restaurant or hotel to see if it reaches your kashrus comfort level.
I just want to point out that in Israel, if you look on a typical Tu'udah, a letter of certification in a restaurant, it lists the name of the mashgiach and usually his cell phone number.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Usually usually will have that information there, which is, I've never seen it in the United States. There it has the name of the agency. But in Israel, you look at the Tu'udah, which you should check. You should really check it to see that it's current and that it's valid. And if you have any questions, you should be able to speak to the mashgiach if he's supposed to be on site. Or if not, you can give him a call and ask him. That little tidbit of information is not given here in the United States. Here, we don't put the mashgiach's name down. We just put just the agency. If you want, you can call the Star K or the OU.
Right. There is another very fundamental difference between giving kosher supervision here in a town such as Baltimore, where you will have all your restaurants along a 2 to 3 mile drag, and that will be your base of operation. While when you're certifying a country and it's replete with restaurants all over, your task is a lot more formidable.
I remember I went into a restaurant in Israel, and it was not an OU or a Star K place, but a place which would be considered, I guess, a reasonable certification. And the certification letter listed, it said rabbi on site, and it had his name, cell phone number. And I asked the people behind the counter, can I speak to the mashgiach, to the supervising rabbi? I want to talk to him, see what's going on. I said, well, he's not here now. Well, the letter says he's supposed to be here, so where is he? Well, he leaves at 11, so he's not here any longer.
Anecdotally, Rabbi, I happened to be in Marseille this year, and the rabbi told me to go to a particular restaurant, which was open, and I came there. There, in France, they do not call the mashkiach, meaning the supervisor, a mashkiach, they call him a shomer, which is a watchman. So it says the shomer is not here yet to unlock the oven. So I had to wait about 45 minutes until the shomer came, and then I was able to have my meal.
Oh, okay, well, that's good. It's maybe inconvenient for a person who wants to eat, but it's good for kashrus.
I was pleased.
Okay. we do have some more questions over here. Let's take them. Okay. According to those who say that one must cover the knob of a crock pot for Shabbos, is there any problem if this covering falls off on Shabbos? The background for this is that the crock pot, well, say you're cooking your cholent in there, you want to make it what we call grufo ktuma, and either you want to line it with aluminum foil, according to some opinions, or you want to cover the knob or remove the knob. So let's say you covered that knob before Shabbos, and then it fell off on Shabbos. Is there any problem with the food? And I was thinking about this question when we got it. I don't really know why you wouldn't be able to just put the covering back on.
Right.
It's not, you know.
You're not, the idea being that it's supposed to be some sort of a sign as you either take off the knobs or to be able to cover the knobs so that you wouldn't adjust it. But the food is already cooked before Shabbos, and that has to be a proviso before you can use it, but as long as your food is cooked before Shabbos, you'd be able to partake of the food on Shabbos.
Well, even if it wasn't cooked, and he was, which it's ideally supposed to be, but if he covered the knob and he left it in, let's say, partially cooked, right, and then it fell off, I don't know why he wouldn't be able to put it back on, and I don't really see it as a great issue with that. Okay, if anybody has any questions, you can join us through Dimdim and chat with us, or by telephone, hit *6 and you can unlock yourself. I do want to mention that coming up next week, in about a week and a half actually, we have our StarKey summer program training in Kashrus, and we have a very interested group, as we do every year. I think this is our 7th or 8th year that we're doing it, and as usual we have more applicants than unfortunately we can handle, and we're very, very much looking forward to it.
Right, and germane to that is that we're having this year Rabbi David Stein from Israel, who is our StarKey field representative actually in Eretz Yisrael and in Europe and in Turkey, and he's going to be addressing the group, and I think a lot of the questions that you raise in terms of Hashkocha and Eretz Yisrael, he has written extensively in Kashrus Currents about the differences in shechita and in dairy and in the other produced products.
Well, what we've asked him to address here is how does one living in Chutz La'aretz in the diaspora, how does he deal with the tithing, the trumas and maaseros, the orla, the shmita, the sabbatical year? Because it's confusing for us, for those who live in the United States. When you get an apple from Israel, an orange, do you have to worry that it might be something from the first 3 years of growth, and then it wouldn't be sufficient to tithe it? It would be completely forbidden. So do you have to worry about that, and you know, those kind of issues?
It's interesting. Rabbi Stein told me that when he was first married, his wife lived on a moshav, and the wedding presents that the moshav gave the young couple is that he studied extensively in a Shemitah Kollel for 2 years.
Oh, really?
And that,
okay,
gave him, that was able to go ahead and to give him a very sound background,
right,
on all these issues.
As far as the Orla goes, the fruits that are forbidden for the first 3 years, I was discussing that this year with Rabbi Stein, and he mentioned that there are five opinions, five basic opinions. So it's a confusing subject, and we want to get some more clarity on it.
That's correct. You if you're in Israel, you'd have to go look at the charts and see the probabilities. We've written about that also.
Well, in Israel, actually, I think that as far as the fruits go, it might be a little bit easier because you're not going to buy anything, any fruit, without a reliable certification.
That's correct.
Here in the United States, we don't certify. You can't go into the supermarket, and if it says Jaff oranges, you're not going to look for a certification in a typical
correct.
Supermarket. So you're stuck on your own.
Right.
So actually, I think for Israelis, it's somewhat easier. And I found that when I was in Israel during the Shemitah sabbatical year, you don't ask any questions. You're just relying on your particular certification, whichever it might be. They take care of it. And many people living there know very little about the actual laws because they don't have to. And here, since it doesn't come up that often, we don't have a particular eye on it all the time. And sometimes the questions come up more often in the United States than they do in Israel.
That's true.
The person who asked the knob question about the crock pot, so you're saying that your son insists on taping on the covering over the knob. I don't know why you would have to tape it on. I think it would be sufficient just to, if you had some tinfoil, to surround
right.
surround the knob.
Scrunch it on.
That's the proper way to say it.
Right. It's a term of art.
Or you could also take off the knob.
Right.
Take off the knob. It also makes a difference to be able to allow you to...
Some knobs have springs on it.
Okay. Then you won't be able to fix it afterwards.
Right.
Okay, Rabbi Rosen, is there anything else that we wanted to get to urgent, or is it okay.
Do we still have time?
We have a couple of minutes. Is there anything else that we...
I take a trip just to check on our Chol of Yisrael farms. I think that the listenership might be interested in knowing, that probably one of the central issues that we have on dairy farms is if a cow... develops a problem called a displaced abomasin, as they call it, a DA, where there's a gas buildup in the stomach of the cow, of how to be able to alleviate the problem without making the cow non-kosher. Because if you do something invasive in the abomasin, you make a puncture or a hole to release the gas, then the milk cow may grow to be healthy again, but cannot be used for kosher production. So in our farms in Pennsylvania, we've instructed the veterinarians to do a similar operation as they do in all the dairy farms in Israel, where they've learned and are taught to be able to suture an animal without doing any type of invasive action, thereby saving the dairy cows and not puncturing any type of an organ.
Is the mashgiach, the supervisor, watching him when he does it?
The supervisor is watching him with avid interest.
Mm-hmm.
Every time. We have a supervisor who lives there 24/7, and therefore he's on call.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when you buy the Chol of Yisrael milk, so you're assured that it doesn't have any problems with the DA cows. And do all of these certifying agencies do it like that, or is there some
difference? In Israel, they do it, but that Israel does not have the luxury of having a supervisor living, that they have to have something like Hatzalah, an on-call rabbi, to go ahead and get to the farm. Others do not have that type of a cooperation. So they'll either have to milk the cow separately, which in some of the farms they milk them separately. In other farms they'll have to sell off the DAs, and sometimes we do that as well. And therefore, or they will have to have separate barns where you will have separate milkings.
Uh-huh. So if a person buys any Chol of Yisrael milk in the United States, can he be assured that this problem was taken care of?
100%.
Okay, that's good. Good. We have a comment here. There is so much choice nowadays in the fruit store. Why buy Israeli produce with all its inherent problems? It's easy to avoid. That's okay, there's some truth to that. The other hand is that we want to support the farmers in Israel. And if a person knows what he's doing and knows how to properly eat Israeli produce, then he would be recommended or encouraged to buy Israeli produce. If a person is not certain, then I definitely would stay away. A lot of times I get a call from a person who went into Costco.
Correct.
And they have Israeli peppers. For some reason, Costco, you get that same
right.
call, right?
So, and it's beautiful produce, and it's,
right.
you know, they feel that they want to support Israel.
Right. So, well, people buy it. The calls I get, usually they buy it, and then they bring it home, and they see, oh, no, it says product of Israel or Israel and Mexico, and they want to know how to deal with it. And on a vegetable like that, if it's not the sabbatical year, it's fairly easy to tithe. You know, if you go through the steps, it doesn't have a question of the orla that we mentioned before, and it's not a sabbatical year issue, so it's fairly easy to deal with. And we explain how to deal with it over the phone, and then I tell them to look at Rabbi Rosen's article, which is available at the Starkey site.
And I see that someone asked the question of how many Americans really know what they're doing
about tithing.
That's a good question. And that's why you have. Yeah,
is he asking about kashrus or in general? How many?
I don't know.
Americans
maybe they're at. Maybe they're
know
at,
what they're doing.
Or maybe they're talking about doing the operations on the cow.
No, I think he's talking about the. Yeah, he's talking about the. It's true. Yeah, that's a good point. If a person doesn't know what he's doing with reference to Israeli produce, then yes, I would agree.
You should know that there is a default position that, you know, a person would go ahead and just say follow what the dictates of the Chazon Ish is, and, you know, sort of that would kind of cover it. But you have to really know what you have to take off.
That makes it a little simpler. Isn't that the old cow problem that the poskim amati? We're going back between cows and
right.
fruits.
Okay, so I don't know if there are those who are mater and there are those who are not. We do have the dictum that if you see that a cow can live for 12 months after taking ill or being in a questionable status, which after we know that the even if you were invasive in an abomasum, which that's corrective surgery. And typically the cow can live,
right?
But nevertheless, we try to take a stringent view so that the particular group who may not want to rely on any types of leniencies. So another thing, like the fish, we try to take the high road.
Right, when a person is buying the Chol Yisrael milk, which is a higher level of kosher than the regular milk that you buy, he is not intending on getting himself involved in a halachic question.
There's another good question of it.
Accordingly, all Star K dairy non-Chol Yisrael is a problem. Well,
it's a very good question.
Yeah.
And ironically, this particular problem, as I have noted, hit the fore on 1994. That's when this whole DA issue sort of erupted. And state of affairs was that because we are on the farm with the mashkiach witnessing what's happening with the in terms of the cows, we were able to basically target the problem.
And we must target the problem.
That's correct.
Right?
If somebody buys non-Chalav Yisrael, basically this issue is not as far-reaching as people may think that it is. It's a very small percentage of the cows that are suffering with the azen, it has been found that with diet it can actually be prevented. So in a non-Chol of Yisrael situation where you buy the milk in the store, we apply the principle of that it goes, the milk has come from the majority, as they call the parsh, meruba kaparsh, it goes from the majority of cows who are healthy, and therefore the problem is not an issue.
So when he's buying, but for Chol of Yisrael, we perhaps have an obligation to take care of it, like you mentioned, because
absolutely.
We are there and we can take care of it.
Correct.
And otherwise, but by the non-Chol of Yisrael, we're relying on nullification, perhaps.
Right.
On a different subject, if one gives a bottle of wine as a gift, is he mechuyev? Is he obligated to notify the recipient that it is non-mevushel, so it's non-cooked wine, and therefore there are certain ways that you have to deal with that wine? I mean, anybody can really, if he's giving it to a religious person, that person usually would be aware that he can look on the bottle to see if it is mevushel or not.
Then if you have your issue, if you're giving it to a non-observant person, then that's okay, a that much is, more sticky.
That would
issue.
Be a question. I would, to a non-observant person, I would give not. I would not give them a bottle of non-mavushal wine. I would give them only wine that is mavushal. Here in Columbus, Ohio, there are no longer any Tums that carry a hechsher. However, CBS and Acid are Star K certified. Okay, well that's good to know. The we do have Tums like. Products with Star K.
And I think you probably can go to our Star K medicine list where you have a listing of, even if it doesn't have carry the certification on it, that there
right.
is
some
a,
of, a some of the, I think some of the Tums would be okay even without any certification, but when it has a certification, you get that additional oversight that you know that it's kosher, not just sort of assuming that it is kosher. Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there, Rabbi Rosen. I want to thank you and
Thank you very much for having everyone
joining us. We are here every month, usually the last Wednesday of the month at 12 noon at dimdim.com. The keyword is kosher. And on the phone, we are at 218-895-1203. Passcode is 2020 pound. Next month, we will be having the class on July 21st, which is not the last Wednesday of the month, but the previous one. And this class, if you'd like to review it or want to tell a friend about it, is located at kosherclasses.org. It's archived there under webinars. And you can go there and find it or tell your friends about it. We want to thank everyone very much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Great. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.